From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. For more than 25 years, Pennsylvania journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal has been on death row for the murder of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. Abu-Jamal and his supporters say he's innocent. He's gone through a long series of appeals to get the conviction overturned. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court justices said they wouldn't give him a new trial. In a separate case that we've been covering on News and Notes, the Supreme Court justices also say they need more time to consider the fate of Troy Anthony Davis. Late last month, Davis was granted a stay of execution just hours before he was scheduled to be put to death. In a moment, we'll get the big picture on the courts and the death penalty with Professor Carl Tobias from the University of Richmond. But first, let's speak with Jeff Mackler. He is director of the Mobilization to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal campaign. Welcome to News and Notes.
Glad to be with you.
So for those who don't know, can you tell us why is this case important when there's so many other contested death penalty cases?
Well, we believe that there were so many violations of Mumia's rights in the past 26 years he's been on death row, that his case is actually symbolic of the fundamental flaws in the criminal justice system. But first, let me say this. The decision of the Supreme Court yesterday referred to just two affidavits that we had filed, one by Kenneth Pate, P-A-T-E, and the other by Yvette Williams. We had alleged that in both these cases, these were witnesses who refuted the central prosecution so-called eyewitnesses who said that Mumia was the killer. Kenneth Pate refuted a confession, and Yvette Williams refuted another key element of the prosecution's case against Mumia. We submitted all of these affidavits, both of these, to the U.S. to the Supreme Court in the state of Pennsylvania, where we lost. And because Mumia's final appeal will be going before the U.S. Supreme Court, we were compelled to submit the Pate and Yvette Williams affidavits proving Mumia's innocence to the Supreme Court. And yesterday, the Supreme Court rejected even hearing them. However, we have a deadline to appeal the federal court decision on Mumia, and we're very hopeful on that. That deadline to submit our petition for a writ of certiorari, which means we're asking the Supreme Court to certify that they will hear Mumia's federal court appeal, we have a deadline of October 20th. And if we get an extension, then it's 3 months after that point. So in other words, the case is still before the Supreme Court, but on the most critical issues. And the central issue is the Batson claim, coming from a Supreme Court decision called Batson versus Kentucky. And we're arguing that Mumia should get a new trial because 11 of 14 black jurors were excluded from Mumia's jury panel. We're also arguing...
Let me jump in here because you're giving us a lot of information all at once. And while we're having this conversation, I do want to point out that we did speak to the widow of Daniel Faulkner when we covered the last development in this case. This time we have a statement from the Pennsylvania State Lodge of the Fraternal Order of Police. The president is Les Neary. And he said, "We support the Supreme Court's rejection of this baseless appeal. The family of Daniel Faulkner has had to live with the pain and loss for 27 years, while Wesley Cook has had 27 years of life torturing the judicial system to allow him to escape from his death sentence." And just to clarify, Wesley Cook is the birth name of Mumia Abu-Jamal. So what I want to ask you about this is when you hear a phrase like torturing the judicial system, there's been a lot of talk about whether or not the families of murder victims have a right to see justice executed in a speedy fashion. And these death row appeals can take quite a long time. On the other hand, you see the Innocence Project and other people finding out that some people on death row are innocent. So how do you balance, in your mind, how do you balance those different aspects of speedy justice with thorough justice?
Well, I'm all for speedy justice. We know who the killer of Daniel Faulkner was. The problem is it wasn't Mumia Abu-Jamal. And we have proof positive. And that's why we're asking for a new trial. And that's why the Constitution of the United States exists, so people have the right to habeas corpus, that is, the right to present evidence and constitutional arguments regarding the innocence of your client. The worst thing we could do is, in the name of speedy trial, execute by lethal injection an innocent man. The killer of Mumia Abu-Jamal was Kenneth Freeman, we're now touring the author of a book who is an incredible writer, and he has written the definitive story of what happened. So, yes, we are for justice, and yes, we are for speedy justice, but we are also for the Constitution. That came out of a revolution in this country in 1776 where you had to give the people the right to appeal. Mumia is appealing before the U.S. Supreme Court. He has a constitutional right to do so. Anyone arguing that we should subordinate the Constitution and Mumia's life for a speedy trial and avoid his right to go to the highest court in the land doesn't know what this country is all about.
All right, Jeff, we have to...
We believe that Mumia is an innocent man, and that's why we're appealing his case.
All right.
And we're going to
prove it. Jeff, thank you. We have to move on to Professor Tobias, but thank you.
My pleasure.
That was Jeff Mackler. He is director of the Mobilization to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal campaign. Carl Tobias is a professor of law at the University of Richmond, has some insights on how the Supreme Court deals with the death penalty. Professor, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
So you just heard a little bit of Jeff's perspective as someone who supports Mumia Abu-Jamal's efforts to be free. But what I want to do is put this in a larger context, because we have been, you know, covering both the Abu-Jamal case and the Troy Davis case. And again, I would reiterate that we have spoken to the family of Daniel Faulkner, the police officer who was killed, that Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted of killing. But I want to broaden this a little bit, because the Supreme Court is delaying its decision in the Troy Davis case. He was granted a stay of execution just hours before he was scheduled to be put to death last month. What's going on with the Supreme Court and the death penalty? What are these cases saying about the court?
Well, I think in part they're saying that the Supreme Court does receive a number of these appeals, but also I think it says that the Supreme Court very seriously considers each of these cases. They receive 8,000 appeals a year and only grant some 100. So there is always a long shot and in this connection. But obviously, as your prior speaker was saying, we want to be exceedingly careful that when someone is executed, that we are absolutely certain that that person committed the crime.
What aspects of the Constitution come into play when the government considers death penalty cases and whether or not justice has been served?
Well, a whole number of considerations in the criminal procedure area, the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendments, which have to do with the right not to incriminate yourself, to confront witnesses, to present evidence, and a whole number of constitutional guarantees. Also, the Eighth Amendment, which talks about cruel and unusual punishment. So all of those constitutional provisions are relevant, and we've seen some of these in the latest term. You may remember the lethal injection appeal out of Kentucky last year. But these two cases we're talking about now are individuals and who are basically, I think, saying that they were improperly convicted of the crimes and therefore either should have another trial. I think both of them are contesting their trials and saying they should have another trial before another jury because they were prejudiced in the earlier cases.
In the Troy Davis case, one of the issues that has really come to the forefront is that the majority of the witnesses in the case are now saying that their own testimony was flawed or coerced or fictitious. And in a case like that, why wouldn't there be a new trial?
Well, as I understand it, at least in Georgia, and there was a very close decision of the Georgia Supreme Court, I believe 4-3, on recantation. But there's a very high standard as to recantation, and four of the seven justices felt that that hadn't been satisfied. Though you can make a very persuasive argument that if a number of witnesses recant, then perhaps the case ought to be retried.
So when you look at what's going on with the Supreme Court now and with these moves to make exoneration a big part of the criminal process. And the fact is more than 100 people have been freed from death row since 1976. What do you see as the trends in how the death penalty is going to be meted out in America? Do you see legal changes coming from the top, from the Supreme Court, or from state levels, local levels?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the Supreme Court, as you remember, last term had the Kennedy versus Louisiana case and was asked to reconsider that, where the court ruled 5-4 that the death penalty for child rape violated the Constitution. And the court in that case and many other cases looks at whether there's a national consensus in terms of mostly state and federal government legislation, and then secondly, exercises its own independent judgment informed by its precedents and its understanding of the Constitution and the right it secures in deciding whether the death penalty is appropriate. And some justices, for example, Justice Stevens recently said that he almost never thinks that it is appropriate. And earlier justices like Brennan and Marshall said that they believed it was never proper. And so I think there is beginning to be some national reexamination, and some states have suspended the death penalty. I believe Illinois did because they felt it couldn't be properly administered. But I think we're going to see developments state by state, and I don't know that we're going to see the U.S. Supreme Court say that the death penalty is unconstitutional.
All right. Well, Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Carl Tobias, Professor of Law at the University of Richmond. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The U.S. military is expanding its footprint in Africa, and that's got some people worried. Plus, a new study shows some hopeful signs in the quality of African governance. We've got that and more in our Africa update with Amira Woods. She's co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Hi, Amira.
Hey, Farai.
So last week, the U.S. African Military Command, or AFRICOM, took over all U.S. military operations in Africa. Before AFRICOM was created a year ago, the American military involvement was split between the European Command, Central Command, and Pacific Command. Those are all different command units overseeing different aspects of the military by geography. Now, AFRICOM is headed by a four-star general, William Ward. He says AFRICOM represents part of a new U.S. strategy to engage with Africa.
I think there was a misperception that the command was being stood up to establish large bases, garrisons on the continent of Africa, bringing in large numbers of troops. Not the case at all. We're not a command that's going to have squadrons of airmen and battalions of soldiers and garrisons of other troops on the continent of Africa. We're not to militarize the continent.
What do you think people on the continent of Africa are making of this question, you know?
I think people see this as an expansion of the U.S. military footprint on African soil. They see it as the U.S. interested in Africa because of all these strategic assets. Clearly, oil is top of the list, with 24% of U.S. oil now coming from the African continent. Controlling oil is key for this administration and for the U.S. in general. You know, I think the other issue people are concerned about is that the Bush administration is interested in countering China and creating a presence that would counteract the influence of China that's expanding on the continent. And of course, the last issue is around this so-called war on terror, where people see Africa as the next frontier in the so-called war on terror. And so there's a tremendous amount of skepticism, in fact, throughout the continent, voices of resistance from governments, from non-governmental organizations, really throughout the continent, saying, what is this? At a time when there is a global financial crisis, when people are facing not only the fuel crisis, but food, global food crisis, this is the last thing that Africa needs, more support, training, equipment for militaries on the continent, and increasing also the U.S. military's footprint there.
Let's talk about governance. Now, in much of sub-Saharan Africa, there are questions of transition, leadership, accountability, but according to a new report by the Ibrahim Index of African Governance, there has been an improvement since 2006. The best governed countries, it says, were South Africa, Botswana, Mauritius, Seychelles. The worst included Somalia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Chad, Sudan, and Angola. So explain a little bit more about how you can even come up with an index of good governance.
Well, you know, this is a very wealthy businessman, Mo Ibrahim, who has decided to create a prize for leadership in Africa. And he's decided to give the prize to these heads of state that he and a cohort of others deem worthy. And so the index is meant to take a basket of sort of political goods, you know, in terms of transparency, of accountability, and to put a stamp of approval on who's performing well and who's not. I guess I have to say I found it interesting that one of the key countries, Equatorial Guinea, that many say is at issue in terms of human rights violations. And, you know, it's interesting that that was off the list. It's quite ironic, you know, that some countries, particularly countries that are oil exporters, interestingly enough, didn't quite make it to the list. So I think it is encouraging that this index has shed light on some of the positive gains on the continent. But I think it is also interesting who's left off the list.
So you're saying that it could have been not quite fair?
Well, I think clearly when it comes to governance, we need to have people say, you know, people within the country having their vote, determining their leaders, holding those leaders accountable. That's the best barometer of good governance, you know. So this is sort of an external actor that is giving a stamp of approval. I think it's a team of experts linked to Harvard University and other universities that have played a key role in determining here who is governing well. And clearly it is, it's positive, and it's important to uphold all the positive images that come out in these types of indicators. But I think we also have to look at opportunities to give indications from the people, from the bottom up, for people to say how their governments are treating them and meeting their own needs within their country.
Now, the area that showed the most improvement was something called participation in human rights. That's a pretty broad umbrella. But if you could tell us one thing that you see among the countries on the continent that you think is going well, from your perspective, not from theirs.
Clearly, one of the things on the continent that goes unnoticed is the expansion of women's political participation. There's a lot of attention to Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, but clearly you have countries, for example, Rwanda, where now a full 55% of their parliament is controlled by women. You know, 18% in the U.S., 55% in Rwanda. It is tremendous to see these advances in women's political leadership, and it's happening right across the continent. I think this is an indicator of what needs to happen in this 21st century, Farai.
Let's move on to a story that's quite disturbing. The BBC has an investigative report that terrorist suspects in Africa are being held in a prison dubbed as Africa's Guantanamo. These are suspects reportedly flown into the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa. And the former prisoners say they were interrogated for months, beaten, left in isolation. What do we know about this story?
Well, this is a story. It's been around now for about a year, but there's more and more information that's coming steadily. It's about Africa's Gitmo, as it's being called here. There are an estimated three, it's hard to tell how many, but at least three secret prisons in Ethiopia, could be some in other countries as well, that are being used by the U.S. as these sites of rendition, you know, being able to pick up suspects without any regard to human rights, you know, and cart them off to these hidden prisons where often they could be tortured. There is really no sense of habeas corpus, any kind of rule of law here within these prisons. I think clearly, you know, you have instances where there are reports of several hundred people being picked up in Somalia, in Kenya, and elsewhere, and taken to these secret detention centers. There are reports of women, even children, being held in these secret centers. So it is worrisome. And I think the concern really is that with all the tension on the other Gitmo, the Guantanamo Bay, Bay, that there will be public pressure to close Guantanamo Bay, but these other secret prisons that are now being strewn around the world will continue to remain in force and will be really a place of violence, of torture, and of core violation of basic human rights of individuals.
Who's responsible for these prisons?
Well, that's the question. You know, clearly the U.S. says these are Ethiopian prisons and it's under Ethiopian jurisdiction. But as we know well, the hand of the U.S. is at play. And you have had officers from the U.S. intelligence and other military forces involved in the so-called war on terror playing a critical role in these secret prisons. So I think what is needed is shedding light on this, you know, and being able to continue to draw attention to what is happening in these prisons so that there can't be this, you know, it's the other person's fault syndrome where the Ethiopian says the Americans says the Ethiopians, and in the end it is innocent people, many of whom haven't had a right to trial even, respected, that those are the ones that are really in danger of having their lives lost and being tortured and severely hampered in the future.
All right. Amira, thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you, Farai.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and she joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Music plays an important part in the lives of most cultures, including those in Zimbabwe. More than 70 years ago, township music started as a symbol of identity and descent in colonial Africa. Today, the music has grown full circle. A new book traces the roots and evolution of urban music in Zimbabwe. Joyce Jenje Mukwenda is the author of Zimbabwe Township Music and produced the accompanying CD. She's currently working on a master's degree of music at Witwatersrand University in Johannesburg, South Africa. Joyce, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
For people who don't understand what township life means in the Zimbabwean context, what was the political impetus for it, and what did it really mean on the day-to-day?
The townships were places where black people were allowed to stay. So a place maybe like Mbare, where my grandparents settled in 1931, our neighbors were from Malawi, were from South Africa. So all those cultures which came together and came up with what they call township culture, which was not for a particular tribe. And then for them to entertain themselves, they started to sing their traditional music, and they brought that music together. So that music became a symbol of identity in the sense that when they played music, people would come and also discuss politics, how they lived, and they helped in the formation of nationalism.
Let's mention a few of the people who you reference in this book, and you reference so many of them. Mm-hmm. August Masarurwa, you have a song that he actually did, that Louis Armstrong covered. But tell mm-hmm. me a little bit about him first, and then how Louis Armstrong would come to cover his work.
August Masarurwa was a musician in the police force. He played the saxophone, and Gallo Recording Company was recording in Zimbabwe. They were scouting for talent, and they saw August Msarua, and August Msarua was playing with his band, the Cold Storage Band. And then when they recorded him, they asked him what was the name of the tune that he was playing, and he said it was Skokiana. The meaning of Skokiana is beer which was brewed in the townships. You could brew it in a day because people were not allowed to drink clear beer. They were also not allowed to brew their own beer, which would take 7 days. So August Msarua celebrated the beer into a song.
This is a broader question, but how much do you think American musicians paid attention to Southern African music, whether it was township music or the music coming from South Africa?
It was people like Louis Armstrong who paid attention to Zimbabwean music then, and then introduced it to the whole world.
You have a chapter about music promoters, and they come from different racial backgrounds. Can you tell me just very briefly a couple of their names and how they could come together to build racial bridges as well as to make music?
People like Eileen Hadam came from an organization which was trying to use music to destroy Calabar because they saw the power in music. Music has no bounds, and the language is understood by anyone, even if you don't understand the language itself. So Eileen Hadam used to come to the township to collect musicians, and sometimes she would use her own house for people to come and watch the musicians play. And then one day Eileen Hadam and Pat Travers organized a show, which they invited black, white. And by the time the police discovered that there was a multiracial show, it was too late. It was about to finish, and they had achieved their goal. And people that day saw African musicians sing, and they couldn't believe it because people were separated by colors.
So you've just told us about, you know, the different ways that this music developed in terms of, you know, audience and race. I want you to mention one more musician, Susan Mapfumo.
Susan Mapfumo came in the 70s, and I always say Susan Mapfumo was ahead of her time, because during the 70s, people had not even heard the word feminism, feminist or whatever. But the way she wrote her music was from a feminist angle, and she was not intimidated by anyone, and she sang songs that talked for women during that time, like Bababa Boye Maita Say, what has happened to you, my husband, you're not bringing money to the family. And she wrote songs to do with the plight of women, and she was the first woman to own her own musical instruments and also to lead a band. Susan was ahead of her time, and she was a great composer.
I understand that you also just produced a CD with four young women and recorded music by Zimbabwean women musicians from the 50s through the 70s. How did that get started? And tell me more about that project.
I decided to go back to the 50s up to the 70s and revive that music. But then reviving the music was a way of also passing it on to the new generation of young women musicians. And by passing it on to young women musicians, it would also be appreciated by their peers, you know. So I collected music from the 50s by Dorothy Masugu, by the two singing nuns, Susan Mapfumo, Susan Chenjerai, who was around in the 60s, by Jenny Chenjerai, and I brought four young women musicians, and they did versions of that music, which was rearranged by one of the best producers in Southern Africa, Louis Mhlanga.
Well, Joyce, it's good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Farai.
Music researcher, filmmaker, and author Joyce Jenje Mkwenda. Her latest book is Zimbabwe Township Music, and she was at the BBC Studios in Johannesburg, South Africa. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. For some people, the American dream is not found on U.S. soil. Instead, they seek it in South Africa. A new documentary, Blacks Without Borders, follows a group of African-American entrepreneurs who have made South Africa their land of opportunity. Stafford Bailey, the director of the documentary, joins me now. How you doing?
I'm fine. How about yourself?
Oh, doing great. We've just had a good conversation about our Baltimore roots.
Yeah.
So always got to recognize. But you have had another long journey going to South Africa to shoot this documentary. How did you even come up with the idea?
Well, when I've done a few things in Africa, and I kept finding people, African Americans living in Africa, and I kept thinking that's a odd place to live. And then I, from my one of the jobs that I do a lot of making of behind the scenes of movies, and I travel a lot, and I keep seeing a lot of African Americans in foreign countries. And then I talk to somebody here, and they say, "Oh yeah, I have a good friend that lives in South Africa." I said, "Really?" And then someone else knew someone. I said, "There's something here." Then I searched the internet, and I saw an article written in. It was, I think it's from an Atlanta paper, and it talked about all these African Americans living in South Africa. I think it was more, it was the second high, I think Nigeria has the most, and then South Africa was growing. And I only thought about apartheid, but you know, I kept thinking, you know, when I saw the images of apartheid. So I started investigating it more, and I started seeing, no, it's not like it. There's a story here. So I went down to check it out.
Give me, you know what, actually, I'm going to go ahead and play a little bit of your film so to give us a sense of what people see there. Here's a little bit from a woman who started a business in South Africa.
I feel more comfortable in South Africa than I ever have in the U.S. You are a person here. You know, you don't have to apologize for being black like you do in America.
Tell us who we were hearing there.
That was Cora Vaughn. She was an attorney in Chicago making over $1 million a year, and then she sold it all and moved to South Africa to run a bed and breakfast. And she lives in an area in Johannesburg. It's one of the most exclusive areas up there. As a matter of fact, she lives up the street from Nelson Mandela. And she just, like, you in the documentary, you hear more of her story, but she really never felt, even though she was very successful here in the U.S., she never felt like she really belonged. And she really never felt real comfortable. And then she just decided, after traveling every year to different parts of Africa, she wanted to see was there a place in Africa where she could actually live. And then she went into moved to Johannesburg, and she loved it. She's doing great. She never looked back. She said, like she says, she has no regrets.
You also talked to two gentlemen who worked in the telecom industry, started a very successful company. Tell us a little bit about their story.
Yeah, Robert and Eric. Yeah, these two guys, they had big, really big ideas, and they decided to come together in South Africa because the opportunity to do what they wanted to do didn't present itself in the United States. And their goal was to become the largest satellite cable provider on the continent. And their thing is if we would have gone into any American bank and tried to say we want to be the biggest in anything, they would have laughed them out the building. And they didn't get that in Africa. Because see, the thing is, in Africa, the glass ceiling doesn't exist in Africa. You can go as far as your ability goes, and it will take you. And that's what's so exciting about them. So they didn't have that a handicap with them. So they had the ideas, they had the vision, and they can go as far as they want to go. And I think they have 40% of the market right now.
But don't you think there's just a different cut on the glass ceiling? Because, for example, you know, there one thing I have heard, you know, going to South Africa every now and then, is that there's a glass ceiling that affects black South Africans more profoundly than it affects black Americans, because black Americans come in, we've got a sort of outsider cachet, and that frankly during apartheid there was a whole generation of people that weren't educated well who were black South Africans. So we come in, you know, having had a civil rights movement earlier, having been able to go to college and get degrees of higher education earlier. And so maybe there is a glass ceiling that affects black South Africans more profoundly. Did you get any sense that there was resentment from some black South Africans?
No, I don't. There wasn't any resentment. As a matter of fact, because of what we went through in the civil rights, we're kind of like their role model. Because they figure we've gone through it. And, you know, a lot of them think everybody in America is rich anyway. But we've gone through their version of the apartheid, and we accomplished things, and that's what they aspire to be. So when African Americans come there, I don't see the resentment. But what did happen in the beginning, there when apartheid first was dissolved, there was a lot of African Americans who came down, who promised a whole lot of stuff and they couldn't deliver. So that put a bad taste in a lot of South Africans' mouth. But the new group that went after that group, all those are gone. A new group came in. That's not a problem with them. It's more because, unfortunately, a lot of those a lot of during the apartheid are in their 40s now, and they didn't get the education that, you know, that we did over here. So they're behind. It's like playing catch up. What a lot of Americans are doing is helping them to, you know, get to that point.
Do you see, and just quickly before we have to let you go, do you see a continued opportunity now during this financial crisis?
It's a perfect place to go right now for the because of the crisis that we have in the U.S. Because in South Africa, it has the fastest growing middle class in the world. In South Africa, as a matter of fact, the middle class is growing so fast it's hard for them to keep up with housing for them, because you know with apartheid you all put on little townships.
Thank you. We're going to have to wrap it up. Stafford Bailey is the director of Blacks Without Borders. He joined us here at our NPR West studios. He's an ordained minister and a pioneering hip-hop star. We're talking about Joseph Simmons, who is the run in the legendary chart-topping group Run DMC. The MTV generation knows Simmons as a devoted husband and father of six from his reality show Run's House, which also stars his wife, Justine.
Oh, Joey, wait.
What?
Diggy or Rusty didn't make the honor roll.
So both of them at the same time is having a problem?
Well, but it's not just the honor roll with Diggy.
There's something going on
Diggy's
in the house
talking.
That's making
Diggy's
them
talking and not being focused.
So that got to be something that we're doing wrong if both of them at the same time didn't make the honor roll.
Something you're doing?
Why do you keep blaming it on me? It's something you're doing or something we're doing. Let's take responsibility and put it on them.
I didn't do nothing different.
Oh, you know what I'm going to do? Instead of blaming you and blaming me, we'll just start fixing it. It's your fault.
I heard you, Joe. It's not funny.
The couple has written a new book on parenting called Take Back Your Family, A Challenge to America's Parents. Both Rev Run and Justine Simmons joined NPR's Tony Cox to talk more about the book and their TV show.
Well, you know, for me, this whole thing is a ministry. You know, as I'm Reverend Run, you know, I was telling everybody, this is a ministry. This is a way to touch people in America and all over the world through MTV. So when I'm on the television and I'm doing the words of wisdom in the tub at the end, or I'm talking to my son in his room about something, I'm letting you into my home to see how I would handle a situation with Rusty if he broke his Game Boy, or with Diggy if he wasn't doing well in school, or with my wife if there's something that's going through us. So the cameras would be in the bedroom, and I know I'm going in there to handle something that we're going through, and you would just be on the end of what's going on in my house and how I handle it. So that's how this show works. It was intentionally not only for me to have a reality show, but for me to show you my ministry. And my ministry happens to be to the family.
But you're an entertainer, experienced entertainer, and you are used to being in the public eye. Mm-hmm. Are your children? They are probably now, but were they as this began?
They were a bunch of hams at the beginning. It was very shocking. The cameras came on and they loved it, and they're asking now every season, like, we get another season?
Yeah.
But we were in church a lot. They understood the point. We didn't just throw this at them. When we first told them about it, we said, this is what we're doing. This is our service to the world. It wasn't like we're going on television to become big stars. That's why the show comes off as it does. We're going on television to serve. We're going to show them how we run our household. We're going to show everybody in the world how we get over, how we have blended families, how we handle situations. We're going to show them why our family works. And they were like, got it. That's what it was about.
But also, people also loved the show and felt like they were a part of us when they see us.
You know, you want to peek inside a rock star's lifestyle, but then that high dives off quick.
I understand. Let's talk about the book, Take Back Your Family. The title makes it sound as if this is a way to help you get your family back to the situation or back in the standing that they should be.
Take Back means to me, you're taking it back from all the things out there that could be distraction. You want to take them back from the streets and put them in school. You want to take them back from worrying about the opinions of their peers to your opinion. You want to take them back. For me right now, I have to make sure that since my kids become stars, that Vanessa and Angela aren't looking to Us Magazine to validate them. Don't give away your powers. I'm constantly telling my kids, your power is not within if we have another season.
One of the things in the book that I read that caught my eye, Rev, was you talked about your experiences with Run DMC and how that when that came to an end, you sort of hit the bottom emotionally and otherwise, and that sort of precipitated your going into the ministry. Is your life now opposite of what it was
I'm on tour with Kid Rock. It's not the opposite at all. I'm signing books during the day, and I'm rapping at night. How that came back about, I don't know. But God came, like, he showed me, I've made you a rapper also. You know, you don't get so caught up in the ministry that you don't rap. People enjoyed that. When I got to a place where things were changing for me, you go where you're celebrated, not where you're tolerated. But I'm still run. When you see me out on stage, you'll say, that's not the same guy that was just preaching. He's screaming all these crazy lyrics and doing my Adidas. It doesn't look like the same guy that's going to be sitting here talking to you about family principles. Mm-hmm. So some things have changed, but basically I am the Reverend Run. So I'm the Reverend and I'm still Run.
Now, does he write the words of wisdom or do you help him write them?
No, he writes them. Well, what happens is he gets up early in the morning before everybody. He gets in a tub. And, I mean, that's where, I guess, he finds his peace or whatever. And he reads the books. He reads the Bible. And then it's like God gives him what, you know, what word of the day. And or sometimes it's whatever he's going through. And it's funny because a lot of people will write back, oh, my God, that was right on point. I needed that word. And then he'll have me probably read it over or something like that.
Two more things I want to ask you. I appreciate both of you coming in. It's really an interesting conversation to me. One is this. Having been married myself, as I've told you a couple of times, I know that there are people who are married who will be listening to this or who are in relationships or have been in relationships who will say, well, that's great for Reverend Run and for Justine. You know, they can do that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, life is hard mm-hmm. for us. And, you mm-hmm. know, it's just not all easy and all fun and mm-hmm. like they're describing. So good for them, but that ain't going to happen for
me. We lost our baby on television. We go through hell. We showed the happy side and we brought the cameras in the house when she lost the baby after 8 months. We went into the hospital. We don't just show a happy life. Everything that goes on in our house is game. We've showed it all on MTV. And I'll argue with her, but I realize at that moment, or she'll realize at that moment, okay, she's not agreeing with me.
Yeah.
One of us are going to have to back down.
No, you keep saying that, babe. I was still making my point. Okay, okay. Anyway, we will argue, but it's like, it's an argument that you know that's getting ready to end. Like, not an argument. Don't look at me like that.
I finished because you cut me off. Go ahead.
Oh, my God, because you've been talking every minute. I want to say something.
Finish your point.
What we're saying is, like, we'll argue, but it'll be, we know this is not, you know, you're not going to go to bed like this. You know, whereas.
But the Bible says don't do that.
But as younger, I didn't always feel that way. You know, if I was mad, I was mad. You know what I mean?
I'm older, and I don't always feel that way now.
Exactly. But I'm not even thinking divorce. I feel like a lot of people just all of a sudden, as soon as things don't go right, they're like, you know what? I'm going to just leave. Like, you know, and I might have thought that years ago or felt like that years ago. But I'm learning this argument. Okay, so let's get on with it. Like,
you know what I find? And I like the question that you're asking. It's very important. And then I'm going to speak this directly to you. The thing that stops relationships from happening, the Bible talks about it's two becoming one. And in order to become one, you have to have the same ideas. In order to have the same ideas, you're going to have to give in a lot. For me, I want my marriage very badly. So happy wife, happy life. So if I'm right or wrong or whatever, I'm willing to just shut up and go into the other room and read the newspaper because I don't want to be right more than I want my marriage. So ego says, I want to be right. So I'm going to tell you what you did today with the kids, with this, is wrong. That doesn't work for a marriage. One of you have to back down. I've made it, and she backs down, but I'm saying I've made it my decision to back down. It doesn't feel good at all.
I'm looking at her right now. She doesn't look like she's backing down.
I'm saying that's the thing
down.
I say every day.
Okay, no, I just don't want to make
no,
it seem like.
No, I said you back down or I back down, but I'm talking about, okay. I'm speaking for myself, honey.
Okay. I just don't want to make it seem like you back down more.
I'm speaking for myself. I can't speak for you. I'm talking about since I want my marriage.
I'm just checking.
See, this is a real marriage.
Yes, it is.
You know, this is what marriage is.
But the key is, how bad do you want your marriage?
And I want my marriage bad, so I'm not trying to be angry all the time. And I'm trying to make him happy. And I will do things that I know he would want to do instead of doing what I want to do. Like, you know, we give in, you know?
I understand. Let me ask this as my very last question, Reverend Run. I really do appreciate this. It has been enlightening and a wonderful conversation. You end your show in the tub. We don't have a tub here.
Okay.
And we don't have any bubbles.
Because he would get in it.
You know, we don't want you to do that.
He lives in a tub.
I bet. It's a nice looking tub, too.
Thank you.
But what we want is
I can give you today's word. You want today's word?
Today's word.
Learn how much you're worth was the subject. It's very important that while you're negotiating your way through life to find out how much you're worth. You must keep a scorecard. Remember small victories. Keep trophies, news clippings. Read the Bible. God will confirm how much he cherishes and loves you. Remember this. In business, people will very seldom tell you how great you are. Why? Because then they have to pay for it. God is love, Rev Run.
Reverend Run, Justine, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
That was Justine Simmons and her husband, Reverend Run, speaking with NPR's Tony Cox. Their new book is called Take Back Your Family, A Challenge to America's Parents. You can catch the entire family on their MTV reality show, Run's House. Video of this interview can be seen at our website, nprnewsandviews.org.